boom. I'm saying the boom here, which is actually a Luis Chaparro thing. Shame he's not here right now, but I'm here with the great Mafia writer, writing on the Mafia, Christian Cipollini. Correct pronunciation?
That's it.
Good enough. Great to be. We've been in contact for a while. It's great to be hooking up and in contact with some of the seasoned Mafia writers in the United States and hooking up with people who've been covering the narco beat in Mexico and people who've been covering organized crime there. I think we can learn a lot from each other. I can learn especially a lot about the people who have covered the Mafia for a lot of decades in the United States. But anyway, Christian, he's a great writer, great reporter. Among things, he did a fantastic graphic novel on Lucky Luciano. Fantastic stuff. We can talk about the man there. But he's got a new book he's working on, which is actually himself has stepped into the narco world, but on the US side, which is a really underreported beat, is cartels in the USA. So a great beat to get into there. And isn't it got a next book coming up on that, which is going to be quite something. And we've got a story as a bit of a taster of what he's working on. But Christian has been for 6 years now in contact with a killer in prison known as El Mano Negra, who is an assassin born in the USA, in California, grew up a bit in Mexico, bounced back and carried out dozens of murders from the 1970s till the 2010s when he was finally caught and working for cartel. So great to be here, Christian. So getting into
thank you. Always a pleasure.
Getting into this then. So let's so first, I mean, how did this come about, this first meeting with El Mano Negra? And how did this kind of jump over from long-time reporting on the Mafia figures to starting to report on a cartel hitman, a figure, an interesting figure we'll get into, but how did this all come about?
Well, the short of it was a colleague of mine, not a writer, but one of those people that deals in artifacts. I guess the buzzword is murderabilia. Like, his specialty was serial killers, mass murders, collecting some mafia guys that like would do art and he'd sell it. It's controversial, provocative vocation.
Sorry, just to get this straight. It's memorabilia of like serial killers or mafia?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So like you sell them off on like eBay and shit. Like you sell.
Yeah.
Like...
There's, you know, regardless of how people think about it, I'm the messenger. Okay. It's, there is a market for this kind of thing. I mean, just an example, a tire from Ted Bundy's VW, like, that's just a random something I'm pulling out. This guy, we had been friends since social media really started taking off because he was in some of the same circles. Well, he reached out to me one day in early 2018 and said, "Hey, I don't know if you ever heard of Jose Martinez, El Mano Negra," and it vaguely rang a bell. And he said, "This guy wants to tell his story. Do you know, he wants to talk to you." And I thought, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. I've had some mob guys like retired or, you know, whatever that have come to me, but it was odd because it was so real time. And I, to be honest, like here I'm being my vulnerable self. I was a little taken aback. Like, well, wait, this guy's like a cartel enforcer and he wants to talk to me. And I deal with, I always said I usually deal with dead guys, like that's my history. And not that you have to narrow yourself, but I said, I entertained it and said, okay, all right, maybe down the road. And literally it was my fault. And I put this in the book, which will come out. I kind of admitted like I was last to the starting line. And Martinez kept asking my friend, because they would talk via the you know, prison phone. Finally, I said, okay, I'll get on a three-way call. My colleague set it up, and the three of us got on the phone, and I was sort of, I don't know how else to put it, enamored. Like, wow, this guy's funny. He has self-deprecating sense of humor. I got it. He wants to tell his story. You know, a lot of these guys don't want to tell their story, but they do, as long as you're careful. So, long story short, a couple months later, he started mailing me postcards and telling a little bit about himself. And then I set up an account. At this time, just so for context, he was in a jail that had the luxury of video visitations. You pay for it, you schedule it, and for 15, 20 minutes, we could talk. And once I figured out I could screen record it, yeah, then I started collecting them.
Fuck, I'm going to hell. 100%. I'd rather go to hell than heaven.
But once I started doing that, it really led to him giving me more info, like, hey, I'm going to send you my handwritten memoirs. And we're talking hundreds of pages, like this guy wrote while he was in jail of his whole history. And once police reports, everything starts coming to my mailbox. And then I was like, yes, I'll write this story. I don't know how I'm going to do it at the time, but the guy was fascinating if his story was true.
Okay. So this is the bridge into this incredible story. Now we said we've got an installment of this story. You can check out on crashoutmedia.com. That's www.crashoutmedia.com. We've got a story there, which is a kind of summary of some of the most crazy stuff we're going to talk about with that you found out. But the book's coming forward. Check it out. There'll be a link below. And I always get a lot of comments with these, like, where's the story? So listen again. Story is on www.crashoutmedia.com. Christian Cipollini's story on El Mano Negra and a little taster of his 6 years of talking, I mean, communication with this serial cartel killer. But just tell people a quick summary, like an abridged version. Who the hell is this guy? What is he? Who is he?
Okay, El Mano Negra was raised, as Yon said, raised mostly in the United States, part of his childhood in Mexico. He was around drug dealing in Central Valley, California as a young man. His older half-sister was suspected murdered and left in the desert, and he decided at a as a teenager to avenge her death, and that was his first taste of killing. 2 years later, 1980, he was a professional essentially, because in the migrant camps he had met a few people. One of them in the late 70s, early 80s had early cartel connections. And voila, he managed to carry off this career until 2013 with only a few minor interruptions in it. So there's a whole social commentary to be had of how did he get away with this for so long? But essentially, his job was a cartel enforcer debt collector, which also involved the violence, obviously. That was part of it. So in 2013, short story, he gets caught for one of these murders and he decides to repent, if you will. Interestingly, not rat anybody out. It was more like, I'll take the rap, and I suspect to this day, even for some things that he maybe didn't necessarily assert himself, but was there, and boom. Because he didn't want other people to get in trouble. So he repents and says to the cops, oh, I killed your guy, but I also killed like 30 plus more. And you can just imagine the cops being like, whoa. So in 2013, not to get in 2013, it hits the news. but it was a brief. It was serial killer caught from California. And then the story kind of died down, which also ties into the social commentary. Why did it? And that's how I recalled, once I started talking to him, I'm like, wait, I wrote about you once, real briefly, in a list of hitmen years ago, but his story disappeared for a long time.
That's what the crazy. So we've got, I mean, this is a part of the big debate about cartels in Mexico. We've got the cartel war down here with hundreds of thousands of deaths, and the US kind of being immune from the cartel violence.
Right.
But some of it, and it has, you know, there's no comparison, it's night and day. The cartels in the USA don't like to leave too many bodies, which puts heat on their activities. However, there are these things, and I wasn't really aware of this story until you came to me with this. So I wasn't really like up in the deal, like, oh, you know, some serial killer. I don't know. It's not a serial killer. It's not a Ted Bundy, just who's like, just raping women and killing women. It's somebody who's doing hits for money. Now, the biggest, maybe his biggest payday, and to give people, you know, a taste of what the kind of stuff he did, which they wanted the death penalty for, was a double murder in Florida. So, and that's a very classic cartel drug related murder. So talk us through that. What happened in Florida that led to the Florida prosecutors wanting the death penalty for this guy?
In 2006, El Mano Negra is called by his boss, who at the time was based in California, and said, hey, we have a problem in Central Florida. You need to go meet so-and-so, get out there. And the key is, and this is very key, the takeaway, this part, retrieve the money. 10 kilos of coke were stolen from a connected dealer who sold to other dealers in those kind of quantities in a home invasion that the dealer suspected. Kind of odd that one of his customers called that very day, asked how much he had on hand, and then masked gunmen come in and take the drugs. So El Mano Negra gets on a plane, goes there, and, you know, interviews the guy who was the victim and said, oh, you know, who did this? Who do you think did it? Goes through the whole story. And then they conducted surveillance on the main suspect. And in typical cartel, you know, like out of Miami Vice, but real life kind of thing, they surveil this guy and then they lure him because he has a day job as a masonry kind of company. Hey, I need you to come do some work on property I bought. Lure him in. Ends up in what was unusual, as you pointed out, this case actually netted the money plus what I would call interest, and they got away with it. Except this time, he killed the two guys. It wasn't just, okay, collect the money, beat them up, let them know. It was, no, these guys have done this before, or at least they suspected. They'd probably do it again in their view, not mine. But so they ended up killing him, but it was almost out of anger too. Jose was pretty much given the option, like, if you can get the money, cool, we'll go from there. But he decided in the last minute, all right, and now I'm going to shoot the two of them in the back of the one guy's truck. So it was like a brutal ending out of a burst of anger too.
But what's the matter? No, the two bodies that are found, and he leaves leaves fingerprints.
DNA. No, you were right. It was one cigarette with DNA.
Oh, it was not fingerprints. It was DNA on the, right. on the cigarette butt. Okay. So DNA on the cigarette butt in a can of Mountain Dew.
Yes.
At the scene, which they will eventually trace back. But he will not go to court for this. I mean, he won't be put at the murder for 7 years. And won't go to court until 13 years after. So what's kind of amazing is that he gets away with this killing. Like his first murder he commits in something like 1978.
Right.
And his last killing is 2013. Right. So he gets away with this for 35 years.
Yep.
35 years of getting away with this. How do you think he does it? How come you know, how does he slip through the system? And in the United States, when generally, you know, you have, and this is during heavy policing times, during the 80s, during the 90s, all of these different periods, he goes through and he's dropping bodies. How does he get away with it?
I think there's a lot of variables in the equation, but I will tell you, because I've asked him multiple times over the years, point blank, how the hell did you get away with this in the elevator pitch? Give me that. Because they, being all his victims, were Mexicans. Okay, pause on that. Follow up. Okay, I think I know what you mean, but explain. Well, it's, and this is his words, because most 99.9% of them were Mexicans, mostly undocumented. It was not an importance in all the crime that was taking place either in Central California or the various states he was in. And for the going to various states, if he would go to Chicago, nobody knows who he is. He's using an alias, has a fake license plate, fake driver's license. He does the job, leaves the bodies, and immediately goes back to California. It sounds like, well, can't they track this down? Apparently not. And again, the social commentary part, not to get into this debate here, but it is something to be said of that. He believes he got away with it largely because his victims were usually other drug dealers who owed money. Some, I should point this out, the other reason he would kill someone is if they were a suspected rapist or child molester. He was very against that. Apparently, a lot of his compadres were similar thinking. He would kill them, and even if they could identify who it was, that took a lot of work, and there were other issues. So again, you know, take that for what it is. His view is it's because they just those cases didn't matter as much.
Now, just to kick back on that a bit, there was this one white American victim in Washington State, still a cold case, but something he claims. But also a lot of police officers, a lot of prosecutors are going to kick back on that and go, that's not true. We try and keep our murder rates down. I mean, you know, it's all the different police departments.
Right.
And there is a sense, I mean, I think that certainly will be true in certain situations. But there is a sense there still is some good police around in the United States.
Sure.
And police that were like, you know, I mean, good at kind of solving crimes and stuff. So it's still kind of amazing. I mean, one thing about Mexico, so he claims 36 bodies.
Yeah, every year, it's funny because sometimes, I mean, it's not funny, but sometimes he'll say to me, he'll call me up, hey, amigo, I totally forgot about this one. And he'll give me like, oh, in 2010, this guy in LA, like, oh, okay, add that to the list. So being safe, I say 38-ish, 39 is probably being conservatively safe.
So 38, 39, you know, bodies. You know, in Mexico, this happens. In Honduras, Brazil, this happens because you have these crazy impunity rates. You know, you have things like 1 in 50 murders being solved. You know, mm-hmm. So you have a 1 in 50 chance of being caught. So you kill and kill and kill and kill. But in the U.S. generally, I mean, there's some bad areas. But he wasn't killing in the most high crime. He wasn't killing in like Baltimore or like
right.
St. Louis, where there's like super high murder rates. And he was killing kind of all over little towns, Idaho, Iowa, you know, here and there. It's still pretty amazing. I mean, was there something about the way he did it, which was he was pretty pro at getting away with this as well?
That's a great question. And I'm glad you asked that because, yeah, I should point out some of the factors involved. Yes, he does seem like he was very particular and cautious. He had a network. Most of the actual murders, there was a whole network of people and plans. And again, yeah, down to the fake IDs. You maybe can't pull that off today, but 1986, it was easier to have fake ID and hurry in and out of a place. There aren't cameras everywhere. So there were a lot of factors. Reading the police reports, some of them, yeah, were very detailed, to give credit to the police. I mean, they tried to, but you're talking about a guy that, say he did it in Waterloo, Iowa. He's in and out in 24 hours. It's hard to catch a phantom. And the one white guy he killed in Washington, they went up there, a couple of them. They watched the guys, saw where to get him. They got him on a freeway and just took off and drove. And he did, if he was in a vehicle, they would drive straight, even if it took like 2 days. They didn't mess around. So in answer to your question, it was in and out, and they were pretty efficient at doing that. You go do the job. You don't even ask too much about the backstory. You identify the mark. You do it how you think would be best and leave the least amount of witnesses. You know, some of them he would lure to places that he knew no one would find them until he was long gone. And cops did, I should point out real quick, in California, he was certainly suspected and questioned on certain cases, some more than others. But they just didn't have enough, because nobody would really rat him out. They didn't make the connection. Jose Martinez is that guy we heard of called El Mano Negra. There were a lot of people that didn't know it was him, or they didn't want to go there.
So these ghost people knew the name El Mano Negra, but like, you know, this the Black Hand comes and strikes, but not who he was, which is kind of, that's a kind of crazy thing. Now, what's scary about this is he makes a point. I mean, he kind of shows by this that you can get away with this, and if there's people with the will and the money, you know, there's a real danger of people, you know, these kind of cartel hits increasing,
right?
People following in his footsteps,
right? Right. The another takeaway I got from his whole story and keeping in contact with him is what you brought up earlier. In Mexico, in the United States, we have a tendency, in my opinion, to think of drug lords from foreign nations and junkies are here. They forget about the middle section. So you have, like the mafia had, enforcers, debt collectors. And to your point, as Martinez told me and told the police when he confessed, he's like, you know, sometimes if I didn't do the job, believe me, there was another guy that could have come. There was always somebody else who would take me out. So you're caught in this kind of, I don't know, once you get into that life, you're kind of caught in the realm there. So I think maybe, not to get ahead of ourselves, maybe it was a relief. Well, I get that sense from him when he did confess. Like, okay, I'm done. I put in my time.
Okay, so we talk about that confession right now. Okay, so they get him for a murder, and this is a kind of defending family honor. He hears somebody bad mouthing his daughter.
Yes.
And I mean, describe the scene then. How does he take out this guy?
I learned this about him very early on, even before I read the details in his memoir. Honor is a big thing, in the sense that he, as a child, I guess, got picked on, and later in court, again, not to give it all away, he was kind of abused in school before he could really speak English well. So he developed a big defense system or anyone bad-mouthing. His way of saying it is, someone said something stupid, which I learned means they either said something derogatory or threatened him, one or the other. His daughter, he's with this guy in 2013 that's, you know, friends with the boyfriend, and he's bad-mouthing the daughter, or at least Martinez says that's what happened. It made him, like, there was no calming. That Jekyll Hyde switched, and he was determined, I'm going to kill him before I leave and go back to California one way or another. And the opportunity, which we won't give it away, happened to present itself. And he did. But yes, that's what got him caught. And he tried to hide, but he was worried the cops were all over his family. And that's when he crossed the border and they were like, we have a warrant on you. And this is true. He actually said, for what? Because he wasn't positive of what won. And then they said Alabama, and he's like quoting him, oh, you know, they got me.
Okay, so they get him in Alabama, and they're like, this guy probably won't crack. And this guy goes, yeah, I killed him, and I killed another 36 guys, and here you go. So these guys, now, they said, they at one point they go, why did you do all the killing? You know, why are you confessing now? And he said, it's time, you know, I've got to pay. Now, it kind of sounds like he repented, but my impression from the quotes you got from him and the audios and what I see, he doesn't look repentant. Would you say he's repentant or not?
Great question. And again, I'm not a psychiatrist. I just know dealing with people in these vocations, you glean a little bit. And in my opinion, it's those nuances when you're speaking to them, particularly in person, face to face, where you see elements of, I don't want to go so far as say empathy or guilt, but a little. Yes, largely it's grandiose, as the therapist would say. He's grandiose, like, oh yeah, and that one time I killed this guy. But I know when he was facing the death penalty, as grandiose as he was, as it led up to the trial coming to a close, his demeanor changed. And I don't think he'd be offended by me saying it, because after he called me, and it was like talking almost to an excited child, like, wow, I didn't. He actually was a little afraid. Now, does that mean he felt bad for everything he's done? No, maybe not. But there was one case, real quick, where I'll say he's told me, and it was in his writings, he killed a guy, buried him in an orchard. Nobody found him for days. He told me, and it was written out before he even told me, I kind of felt bad for the guy's mom, so I went back and dug him up and dragged him out so that he could find him. Now, that sounds morbid and bizarre, but when you're speaking to him, you realize he actually had that moment of, well, if that happened to me, my mom, you know, wouldn't know where I was and all that. So he, in a warped way, thought he was doing the right thing, I guess. You know, that's...
You get a very interesting area now of his mental state. Now, he's not, I think you're saying, he's not a traditional psychopath of having no empathy at all, but he is, in a sense, has a certain derangement. And at his defense, he didn't get the death penalty, because at the defense, they said this guy was a victim of incest. Mm-hmm. And they had a neurologist saying this actually affected his brain and his nervous system. And he also had brain damage in a motorcycle accident. Right. And they kind of piled on malnutrition, abuse, all this kind of stuff. It kind of makes, in some ways, that makes it more scary to think of this slightly deranged person who doesn't, not really fully in their functions, killing people. But what was your sense of him as his kind of mental state, and how he would flip from that, you know, and you described this kind of nice granddad figure with this kind of, funny moustache and kind of right. Chuck with this kind of missing tooth, kind of goofy mouth, to that guy who's suddenly like killing these guys and torturing guys and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it is bizarre to be in the disarming, charming mode where you're talking about, favorite foods, how he used to, take his grandkids to the park and things. And then when it switches to, okay, what do you miss about being a free man? And sometimes it'll be the casual, well, like, I miss the good food and seeing my family. Other times it's a complete switch 180 to I miss blood. I miss my guns. I'm quoting there. That's where you know, I think in his mind, again, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think he was able to compartmentalize and balance as best you can the two worlds, but sometimes they convert and like switching is not controllable, such as the case that put him in jail for like the one that got him caught. That was out of, I can't control that side of me. I'm so used to killing, I don't even think about getting away with it. I just do it. So it's to me, it's a really murky area of variables coming into play, I guess.
And there's this weird kind of animal instinct of killing and people enjoying and getting addicted to murder, which is a crazy factor. Now, we're just running out of time, but very quick anecdote. I mean, we can go on for hours in this, and there's a book's worth of material, which is why there's a great book coming. But just a quick anecdote, one of the many, many crazy anecdotes. He met El Chapo. Tell that story. How did he meet El Chapo?
He claims in 1991, end of the year, his boss, who you'll learn it goes by Mr. X. That's all he says. The boss calls him and says, hey, are you home? Are you home alone? Because I got a special friend that needs to use the restroom and I need to meet with him. Martinez says, sure, I'm here. The kids are out or my wife's away. And they came up and he realized who it was he met was Joaquin Guzman. And he excitedly to this day says, I met him twice. And the first time he used my bathroom, El Chapo used my bathroom. So some people have argued there's no way El Chapo was in California ever. And I questioned him with that. I said, you know, skeptics are like, really? And he gets irritated and he says, journalists don't know what the hell they're talking about. He goes, he wasn't famous then, but he had a lot of money. And yeah, he came to California because he had family and friends here. He said to me recently, El Chapo could go wherever he wanted in 1991. Nobody knew who he was. Okay, good point.
There's a lot of different things he brings up, which makes his testimonies look very credible. Very quickly, where can people follow you, see your stuff, and find out when the book's going to come out and where to buy it?
Thank you. For the time being, you can find me on Instagram. I had to rebuild a new one, but it's Gangland Legend Part 2, the number 2. I'm on Twitter, Gangland Legend. Facebook, just Christian Cipollini. Follow me. Yes, I'm going to re-put my website up soon. I'm redoing the whole thing, so I apologize. But you can follow me in those places. Reach out to me if you have questions. YouTube, go to Yone, and of course, Crash Out Media, because you'll be seeing some cool stuff there.
Yep, so that's it. We're going to have an outro boom. And check out the story about El Mano Negra and Christian's time talking, trying to understand and tell the story of this guy, because it's important to know about what cartels are doing in the United States. It's not only something in a foreign country for you Americans, it's something happening in the United States. And check out the story on www.crashoutmedia.com. Get a paid subscription if you're feeling this. Support true independent journalism. There's also an option, if you like, for buy me a coffee, if you want to just chip in a cup of coffee to keep us going. And we love you as always. Boom outro.